Welcome, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this incredibly important conversation between two scholars who have spent a great deal of time thinking and writing about these issues. Allow me to introduce Dr. Emily Channel Justice, who is the director of the Temerte Contemporary Ukraine Program at the Ukrainian Research Institute of Harvard University. She is a sociocultural anthropologist, and she first started learning the Ukrainian language and carrying out research in Ukraine in 2012. She pursued research on political activism, social movements among students and feminists during the 2013-2014 Euromaidan mobilizations. And our other guest this evening is Dr. Christina Hook, who is an assistant professor of conflict management at Kennesaw State University School of Conflict Management, Peacebuilding, and Development. A specialist in Ukraine and Russia, her expertise includes genocide, mass atrocity prevention. And as an anthropologist, Christina began conducting ethnographic fieldwork in Ukraine in 2015, analyzing archival records of the Holodomor and the historical memory of this event for Ukrainians today, prior to her time at the Department of State as a policy advisor for conflict stabilization and in leadership roles with several non-governmental organizations. Dr. Hook wrote an article for the Ukrainian National Women's League of America titled "The Holodomor as Genocide, a Social Science Approach to Understanding Past and Present Violence in Ukraine." This article appears in our November this month's issue, which is dedicated to the memory of the Holodomor. We are very honored to have both Dr. Channel Justice and Dr. Hook with us today, as we all this month honor the memory of those who perished 90 years ago during the Holodomor. And we look to see and hear what parallels might be drawn to what is currently unfolding in Ukraine today. So without further ado, I present to you Drs. Channel Justice and Dr. Hook.
Thank you so much for the invitation. Thank you, Christina, for joining me for this important discussion. To all our viewers, Christina, I'll just begin by asking you to maybe talk a little bit about the article that you've published in the journal and why it's so important that this article comes out this month.
Thank you so much, Emily. I've really been looking forward to this conversation. Whenever I give these presentations, I think this particular venue is really crystal clear why this topic matters. We're so grateful for the opportunity to have the Ukrainian National Women's League of America give us the opportunity for this discussion. And we know that by doing so, they're gathering also members of the Ukrainian community and the audience that's here with us today. And for all of my talks, those are some of the most meaningful because I often have survivors or survivors' descendants in these talks. These talks are really important for just keeping that memory alive, for talking about a story that was illegal for many years, for making sure that there isn't any kind of impunity that Stalin can get away with, as well as that theme that we're having about the current escalation under Putin and conversations of getting away or impunity with prior acts of violence. I appreciate the introduction because it gets around a couple different aspects of my background that this case is also really helpful for us in seeking to really take practical steps towards the genocide mantra that we all share of never again. It's easy to say, even with a lot of heartfelt conviction, but how do we enact something like never again? How are we able to anticipate where genocide might happen? Or so once that's happened, what steps can we take in very practical ways to stop it? And in order to do so, we look at a lot of historical cases. And so it was this topic that first drew me to Ukraine, which is now the center of my work for the past almost 8 years, in a place that I know both of us have spent a lot of time and care a lot about. I was drawn there because I knew about Stalin. I knew that he was a totalitarian. I knew he was responsible for some of the worst crimes that we can speak of in the past century, but I wasn't really sure if this case met the way that the genocide scholars like me often speak about genocide. And so I wanted to really look at the archival records and without feeling that I would put my finger on the scale a little bit. I didn't have a pre-ordained conclusion. So I went and I started doing archival work. And I'll just mention a little bit too, if it's all right, about questions that people have about comparative genocide research. It's really challenging because often genocides are happening with a kind of a whole of society effect. So you'll see maybe the most powerful people, the sort of direct authorizers of violence, if you will, this would be Stalin in this case, but they're carried out by direct perpetrators, which would include in the Holodomor, the people requisitioning grain. They're also involved with the bureaucracy that does, let's say, those edicts to take grain for the first time. And so it's just, it's a big social enterprise to organize a genocide. And it's a real challenge because when you're looking at even that top level of leadership, even with Stalin or other cases that I've worked, they're often in, at minimum, an authoritarian context to control that kind of bureaucratic mechanism. And because they're authoritarian or totalitarian, they often don't ever feel the need to really tell their subordinates what they're doing, who they're targeting, and for what purpose. It's common in our field to not really find explicit written declarations from even lead authorizers about, I am targeting this group of people for this reason. And so the way that we work, both my work in the Holodomor and then in other cases, is we use what's called in social science proxy variables. So we've looked at, for the last 60, 70 years of genocide research, we've looked at the Holocaust, we looked at a lot of other cases, and we found these indications that we expect in the record. They're getting at these deeper perpetrator motivations. That's what I began to see when I was looking at the case of the Holodomor, that all of those indicators that I was expecting to see did begin to emerge in those documents for me.
I want to follow up a little bit on this methodological question. We're both anthropologists, and for me, anthropology is so often a contemporary discipline. It's something that we use to look at what's happening now and to understand. We always have to look to the past to understand our context. It's not always evident that anthropology can help us understand a particular moment in the past that's already happened. Can you talk a little bit more about how the field of anthropology led you to this type of study and how you use anthropological methods such as ethnographic fieldwork in addition to your archival work?
Thank you so much. It's a great question. It also shows that I wear a little bit of a split hat, and on purpose. When I began this work, I was doing my doctoral dissertation at the University of Notre Dame. And so they have a joint program, which was anthropology and peace and conflict studies. It's a pretty rigorous program in terms of you have two departments, and you often can hear that interdisciplinary tension in our field, exactly the types of themes that you're talking about. And so it's a little bit of anthropology with also a comparative genocide lens, which is very much an interdisciplinary discipline. I've always found that anthropology really has something to bring to the table. And even that there is this kind of growing voice within anthropology that talks about historical anthropology. So I think what it does is it begins to look at genocide, not just as a term that is so horrific that it can cause us to even want to look away, but it invites us to look at genocides as a complex social behavior, which is what anthropology is all about, this exploration of what it means to be human, even this very dark side of being human. And so my argument for my fellow anthropologists has always been that we have something to say here because genocides are really an extreme form of social behavior. And because of that, there might be commonalities that we can pull in, that we also want to keep our contextual sensitivity as anthropologists. That's something we like to bring to the table. We like to talk very much about the details of this specific context. But my argument's always been that genocide, for a variety of reasons, against a variety of groups with all of their rich and nuanced complexities, still is a very extreme form of social behavior. And we can really tease out some of those social dynamics because of that.
I think that's absolutely fascinating. I've never really thought about it this way. So for me, that's really enlightening. Let's talk about the other side of making the choice to do this kind of research, which is the Ukraine side. You said that this case of Holodomor brought you to Ukraine. That's what kind of drew you there. For you, what was the process of learning how to use the archives in Ukraine? What language skills did you have to develop? How did you establish connections? For someone who's not Ukrainian, who doesn't have a background that comes from Ukraine, we both know that we're starting from basically scratch. So can you talk a little bit about that process?
Absolutely. One of the things that I do love about anthropology too is that we just get to spend a lot of time listening. When I went there, I had Russian language skills, which is why I knew that archival work would be a first step that I could take, a first step on what I knew would be a multi-year journey. The archives are in Russian, and so that is an important language for understanding the Holodomor, although a lot of oral storytelling and memories is now in Ukrainian. But when I got there, and one of the things that my work has really expanded from just archival research, because when I got there, I was doing interviews. I wanted to hear from different people who interact in their professional roles with the topic of genocide. And I wanted to hear what the Holodomor story meant to them. So what did the Holodomor story mean if you were a civil society activist? What did the Holodomor story mean if you were a legislator or someone working in the legal field? What does the Holodomor mean if you're a politician or a policymaker? And what does it mean if you're an academic? And I picked those four categories because I've done three of them myself. And so I know that when we interact with this concept of genocide, that it can mean slightly different things just because of the professional nature of our work. Basically, everyone's bringing something to the table, but they're all a little bit different. So a lawyer is trying to establish that genocide can be prosecuted and the way that we speak about it can withstand legal scrutiny and hold perpetrators accountable in a court of law. A policymaker like me is really looking at how we can stop something in motion, and we're trying to figure out how we could, my previous role, how we could organize chaos really fast to make some kind of meaningful intervention, whatever that may look like in a certain context. A scholar is usually focused on either a topic, if you're a genocide scholar, or a context like Ukraine, and is really looking at a lot of rich detail. But then how you translate all of that rich detail for policymaking. And then also civil society plays a hugely important role, especially in the Holodomor. They kept the story of Holodomor alive. And so I really wanted to speak with all of these groups and not just stay in the archives. So that also is why I started learning Ukrainian in 2015. And it was really a language that is dear to me today. Whenever I hear someone speaking Ukrainian today, I know that we've all had hard things happen in our circles this year. And there's a real sense of kindred spirits, I think, right now. I feel very privileged to speak Ukrainian. I started off this long answer by saying that anthropologists get to listen. I had a host university in Kyiv, the University of Kyiv Mohyla Academy, who has just been a wonderful host for my research there on several different fellowships. But when I began to speak with these four different actors that I talked about, there was a theme that kept coming up within all of them. And the theme was kind of this fear that Stalin has done this in the past, that there was this Moscow of the past, and that there was a lot of concern spoken to me from 2015, which was the early day of the armed conflict beginning, that it might happen again. This article is really just on a scholarly case for genocide, but my larger work is really on telling the story of how these four groups of actors really saw so many things coming, because I expected so much more disagreement. I've been in these four different roles. And even though we all try to work together, we just view things a little bit different. We're looking for slightly different evidentiary standards. And so I really expected a lot of disagreement. And I was finding a lot of convergence in the story that people were telling by people that were really also offering a lot of perceptive commentary about other things. And so for me, the story of the Holodomor is actually what really began to raise my concerns that the current escalation could happen, but also really began to clue me in on the fact that very different people were also going to be ready to stand up. They understood the historical stakes of what it would mean. Thanks for that question.
That's a really excellent segue into talking about the current moment. You mentioned already that you have, and you've written pretty extensively on this, that there's evidence that we should be calling this particular part of Russia's intervention, invasion, attempted takeover of Ukraine, we should be calling this a genocide. I wonder if you can tell us a little bit, this is going to be a long question. First of all, what have you learned from your previous experience in studies of genocide that are indicating that this is in fact a genocide? Secondly, why is it important to advocate that it is in fact a genocide now while this war is ongoing? And as we're constantly being bombarded with new information and mostly often new information about atrocities, what is the expectation of the response from the international community if this is in fact designated as a genocide?
Thank you. These are the most important questions that I feel I answered today. So if it's all right, I'll just take 2 hours on them. No, but I do want to walk through actually all three of those parts because they're really important. There is a lot of disagreement, even within scholars who study genocide, which is a good thing. Social science is richer by lots of debate, lots of critiques. But there have also been what we call in the social sciences, these meta reviews, scholars who have gone to all the painstaking work of reading the hundreds and hundreds of books and articles that are published on particular aspects of how genocides unfold every year. And those have been really helpful. They've been done in the last 15 years because they pointed out that a couple of things that were really important. First of all, how much disagreement we unconsciously bring to conversation. Of genocide. One of the meta reviews show that even genocide scholars, so we do this all day, every day, even genocide scholars in the major books that were published on genocide in the year 2008 when the study was done, they were all actually using the term genocide in a slightly different way. And that's a problem just if you're trying to stop violence in real time. You've got to know what you're looking at so you can better tailor your response. But all hope was not lost because the same meta reviews were saying like, okay, there are lots of things that the field will always disagree on just in terms of how we do the business of social science. But there's key consensus around two main questions. And if you can answer these two main questions, then there's really field-wide consensus, even in our interdisciplinary world, about what separates the unique social phenomenon of genocide from other forms of also severe, equally heinous. One's not morally worse than the other. We're actually trying to stop all of them. But that can separate this unique social phenomenon of genocide. And those two questions that you want to ask are, who is targeted and for what purpose? So when you're asking who is targeted, we work a lot of terrible, heinous cases, but some cases, for example, teenage boys are often singled out because they're viewed as future combatants. They're viewed as a real threat by perpetrators of violence. But that doesn't exactly fit the kind of perpetrator ideology of genocide where destruction of the entire group is being pursued with a great deal of effort. So for genocides, we expect to see more of what we call in technical speak, unqualified group selection. So we're looking at men, women, children, a lot of different variety within the targeted group. And then we're also looking at ways that we can tease out what is destructive violence from what is severely repressive violence. And again, these are both heinous, but they are different logics. So repressive violence, if you're the perpetrator, you're seeking to harm the victim group, you're seeking to batter it, you might be seeking to enslave it, but you want to keep those people alive, but in a just a subservient, cowed, subdued role. With destructive violence, you're seeking to eradicate those people's core identity. And that can happen, as I'll segue to, through killing or through what we're seeing today, which is forced russification. But it's really a destructive logic. And that's something that I saw in the Holodomor. It's actually quite clear in the documents to me when we're looking at these ways that I use for all of the genocide cases I work on at teasing out this destructive violence and teasing out this victim selection. We can see both of them in the Holodomor. So that's really what we look at. I think your second question, I might answer them in a different order, but the logics of violence for genocide and for these other heinous forms of mass killing are just really different. Knowing that from my policy experience, perpetrator logics, the interventions have to be tailored to where that perpetrator is at. It's actually the hardest, I think, to stop genocides because people are very ideologically motivated. This is a psychological commitment to wipe out a group of people. So they're willing to take greater risks. They'll go to greater inconveniences. They'll have these kind of what otherwise might be idiosyncratic behaviors. So some of them that we've seen that I'll draw a parallel to both the Islamic State, ISIS, the case that I worked, as well as what we're seeing today, is this pursuit of victims. So with ISIS, we saw them pursuing the Yazidi group up a mountain. We also saw that in the Holodomor, by the way. It was very significant for me when I saw in the historical documents about very careful record keeping about Soviet soldiers pursuing fleeing Ukrainian peasants, catching them, counting how many they caught, and then often putting them back in their famine-ravaged villages, sealing the villages until those people died, and then often in these same areas, bringing in resettlement campaigns for other groups. that pattern is a little different today, but is still very similar. We've often seen evacuation caravans targeted by Russians, or you've seen really willful efforts at population control and pursuit of victims. Now, that's risky behavior. I've seen other cases where, you know, you just want to batter a group, scare it. It's much easier to do something heinous, but less inconvenient, less chances that you'll get caught, like throwing a bomb in a marketplace and just running away. So when you're actually pursuing victims, you're going to a much greater length. And you're really communicating there, as was the case in the Holodomor, and as is the case today, that it's not just about the land, the looted possessions, both in the Holodomor and in the case of modern Ukraine, where I've talked about pursuing these evacuation caravans. It's not enough to just drive victims from their home and to take their land as the gain. That's your goal. But you're actually seem to be after the people itself. And that's a really different logic. And that also is really challenging to stop, because it's indicating that you're not bought off by just stealing everyone's life savings. And so that's really why it matters today. So I have written other articles too on what's happening today and trying to walk people through the kind of different roles that people play. So I talked about that previously in the Holodomor. I talked about Stalin was a key authorizer. There was even a Kyiv court that looked at the key architects of the Holodomor and of course found them guilty. Incredible case there. But those people would be the authorizers. But what about also this constellation of bureaucracies and military structures that are also carrying it out? You've got to go into the situation with that awareness, because whether it's Stalin or Putin, I'm arguing always that this is a really distinctive social phenomenon. And when these leaders unleash these social dynamics, that genie can't really be easily put in the bottle, even by totalitarian, authoritarian leaders. You see a moral calculus changing in the society around, where pursuing victims is not just an unfortunate thing that you have to do. So in the Holodomor, it might be, it's unfortunate, but they're resisting collectivization. Or today it might be, it's unfortunate, as Russia was claiming falsely, we're not trying to target civilians. But really it changes from this unfortunate ethical behavior to something that's actively beneficial. For example, in the Holodomor, it would be, we have to do this. It's a good thing for the Soviet Union. Or today it would be, we have to do this. This is for our Russian grandchildren. I've seen language like that. To sum up that very long answer, we do look for these distinctive patterns of who is targeted and for what purpose, for a destructive intent that does lead to a really different logic. I also want actually crimes against humanity and genocide to be prosecuted in a court of law. They're all heinous. They all deserve their day in court and their justice. But I've argued, if we had been able to stop the Holodomor then, and as we're currently trying to stop Russia's actions today, we have to really tailor it to not what we wish the case to be, but what we see perpetrator and societal dynamics around it shaping up to be.
That's so helpful. Those parallels, they're heart-wrenching to listen to you make those connections, but I think it's really helpful for us to really understand the scope of what we're dealing with right now. So I have two questions that came out of that response. The first one has to do with documentation, because of course, one of the things that we know about Holodomor is that the evidence was repressed as much as possible by the Soviet authorities so that no one would learn about those crimes. I'd be curious to hear you reflect a little bit on the different kinds of documentation that help you find the evidence that you found for your research about Holodomor versus the kinds of documentation that we have now, which of course it's a completely different landscape in terms of how we find evidence and what that looks like. But the parallels of the kinds of practices are so striking. It's just, we're seeing the same thing be repeated. It's just that we can visualize it in a really different way. If you've thought much about that, I'd love to hear your take on it.
Thanks. There are a few outstanding questions for me that I feel like we really have enough to have a clear understanding of it, genocide, but there are these silences in the historical record, and there's a lot of brilliant scholars. I have a long list of people that I would love to introduce, anyone interested to in the audience that I get together with that also work on the Holodomor, that specifically talk about these silences in the historical record, that talk about all the eyewitness accounts that were suppressed, and the ones that did survive are very important and precious to us in the research community. Now, we did have decades later, a U.S. congressional commission led by James Mace that also led to capturing a lot of those stories, which this was in the 1980s, but it was very important just for the age range of Holodomor survivors. And I've been privileged also to interview people who were Holodomor survivors. This is my sort of standing invitation in the field. If there's ever a Holodomor survivor that wants to share their stories, then we can make that happen. It's very important to collect all these stories. When I was looking at this case, I really was very interested in perpetrator dynamics. And so we had enough for that. Now, when I wrote my first master's thesis on the Holocaust, and there is more bureaucratic documentation for the Holocaust, meticulous record keepers down to the mid-level groups, there have been these massive volumes on Holocaust bureaucratic mechanisms, which have been really helpful for me in the work that I do, and that we don't always have with the Holodomor. I'm not convinced that they're not there. They're just sometimes in Russian archives, which are no longer possible. But we do have, actually in the 1990s, a lot of those documents that were significant for understanding Stalin and his inner circle's genocidal intent were actually published from Russian archives, like published in books. Even so, the original records are not always accessible. We have more than some people think. And in Ukraine, there were different waves of declassification of these Soviet records. There were several significant ones since I began my work and even after the Orange Revolution, even more recently. So we really have enough to look at those key architects of genocide. That doesn't always tell us everything we want to know. I always want to know more about the victims and people were. The story of really doing the ethnographic work I did, which was talking with a lot of people from those professional fields, but people who were the descendants. It's just stories of family memories, and every family memory makes me want to go and collect 100 more because they are so important. And it was illegal to talk about those stories. People knew. People weren't always able to tell their whole families. So I would learn of people who later found out they'd had siblings who had been killed under Holodomor, but their parents didn't tell them for reasons that they might let those dark secrets slip and then endanger the family. But many of those stories were kept. Now, for the records with Stalin, we've got enough that there has been sometimes for a long time in the field that people saying, do we have enough to even make a definitive conclusion? So I really want to say strongly that, like, yes, I believe we do. And I've published research on it. You can see this clear overlap for Stalin and his inner circles, what they were thinking, what they were planning, very much in keeping with the type of documentation that we've also had for other cases I've worked on. So I don't think that's a serious concern for genocidal intent. Now, you asked me also about documentation and what's going on now. And just the role of the technology age is very much shaping both our understanding every day. I think we're all in social media checking in with our Ukrainian friends and colleagues, looking at all of these videos and social media posts. Our planning now for prosecution, I'm involved in several efforts for that. This is a comment about technology, not about how much genocidal intent was present, but we have talked in my professional circles about just given the advance of technology, if for the Nuremberg trial, we had hundreds of cases for legal documentation and legal discovery for the court process of prosecuting the Holocaust against Jewish people and others by the Nazis. For Bosnia, we had thousands. And then for Ukraine, we're really looking at possibly millions of records, because there's so much documentation. There is this growth of open source intelligence. So people online who are actually able to do some work that is of great service to investigators. So we are also thinking a lot about that. But a few of us are trying to approach this as technology helping us. This is like another hat that I won't get too sidetracked on, but I often work with computer scientists on research projects related to Ukraine. My computer knowledge remains pretty rudimentary, but we're on these interdisciplinary teams because they're able to talk through how we can use artificial intelligence for sorting different things, for helping get through what we talk about as social scientists, like the data cleaning or data organization, so that we can then, with our human specialization, look at the evidence in front of us. For a long time, it was about data collection. And even in the Holodomor, we might talk about that because it was suppressed. The records, even in Ukraine, were not always declassified. So it was really a question of data collection. What's going on now, it is collection always, but it's also about organizing that data because there's so much of it coming that the metaphor we use is like trying to fill this small porcelain teacup with a fire hose. So how do you do it in such a way that you can make sure that no one's story is lost and that everyone has their day in court?
you've given me the perfect segue to the next question, which is about justice. What does justice look like in both of these contexts? Do you have any speculation on what we could see about holding Russia and Russian actors who have perpetrated both of these genocides on Ukraine accountable?
Yeah, I often think about this because I think about how much I had to learn. I was always very interested in the Soviet Union and obviously the great evils that were done, always really impressed with these stories of dissidents that would come out from the Soviet Union. But I still had a lot to learn about the Holodomor before I started living and working in Ukraine. And so I'd love to see it more in our curriculum and our education. I think that's important. And I often wonder, I think that we've also had these conversations since the war began about how was the largest country in Europe with a huge population of, let's say, 44 million people missing from people's mental map of Europe. How did that happen? And I think that the Holodomor and the repression of it was part of that story. I think that it did lead to these questions of impunity that we're having today. And these questions of, I think a lot of us who are trying to raise alarm about concerns that we saw, the rhetoric that we've seen for the past 8 years of this armed conflict that didn't just begin in February. How was it so hard to make this case? Why did we have to answer questions over and over again about this being a civil war, which it wasn't? It was nice to see the court case come out of the Netherlands about MH17, just because it clearly talks about the role of the regular Russian military forces. I think the Holodomor is a part of that. It's important for honoring the victims. It's important for me as a kind of technical specialist to do everything I can to support and participate in commemoration, education, and then also in my small way to try to honor the victims by saying that I see your story, I know it happened, and I'll do everything I can to both help stop what's happening in Ukraine today, as well as help people in other locations that are experiencing violence. We've also seen incredible solidarity of Ukraine countries that are experiencing protests like Iran. So trying also to talk about this case of the Holodomor in solidarity with others. It's also important for the story of the Holodomor. I was really interested in how the U.S. Congressional Commission happened in the 1980s. And in my dissertation, I wrote about this massive protest that was held in front of the Soviet embassy in the 1980s by not just Ukrainian Americans, but with a significant role by Jewish Americans. Solidarity that they played was victims of another major European genocide. So I think that, you know, solidarity, education, stopping genocides, understanding these social dynamics, and then again, this question of impunity. Why was it so hard for Ukrainian voices to break through? Why was Ukraine missing from people's mental maps?
Yeah, I completely agree with all of that. So thank you for articulating it so nicely. I'm going to ask one more question, and then we'll be happy to take audience questions. So please do submit them in the Q&A function. And that has to do with the question of starvation. So we've seen already food resources being politicized, being used as a political bargaining chip by Putin. You've written some things that talk about how that echoes some of the tactics used during the Holodomor. But maybe you, for those people in the audience who haven't read everything that you've written about this, maybe you can talk a little bit about the role of starvation and potential food crisis.
Sure. So it's really a way of using food as population control and population targeting. And sometimes there are some questions about the Holodomor that people have. And one of them is, does willful starvation count? Because for sometimes people think about genocide as maybe shooting deaths or Rwanda's hacking deaths with machetes, or of course the horrific gas chambers in the Holocaust. But yes, like starvation is certainly a part of whether there are questions of whether Stalin orchestrated Holodomor from the very first days or whether he capitalized on other things to willfully, intentionally accelerate it, that really none of those on their own are an issue for conversations of genocide, because comparative genocide studies is really focused on the intent of violence, which is carried out in different contexts through different methods of violence. I've had people read some of my dissertation or parts of my book, even colleagues in the field who say they kind of had to put some of these stories down because they were crying, because the role of starvation, the slow dehumanizing death that results in both psychological changes for people as well as physical changes, that results in really other very extreme antisocial behaviors like cannibalism, just because it's also precipitated with a lot of just psychological breaks. it really plays a role in collapsing the social order. So things that our societies depend on, things that were really well developed in Ukraine's traditional agricultural society at the time, where things like values of sharing. So if you have these people working together on farms, working together to build barns, all of these social practices in that type of economy that are structured around sharing, when you have starvation, suddenly it's every man for themselves, and it ruptures those things that have made societies thrive. And so the role of starvation, it's just it's a terrible way to die because it's very slow. And I think that it did play a role in why the story was very challenging to talk about for a long time. There was, of course, the fear because of Stalin, because of this top-down pressure, these treason laws where it wasn't just the person who told some dangerous secret that could be targeted, but their entire family, even if they had no prior knowledge. But again, also just the kind of stories that people have that I've collected in my work, they're very painful and very difficult to talk about. And I think some of that might also be why certainly these memories were kept alive in famines, but there are many people I talked to that found out later, or their grandparents or parents told them parts of the story. I have a few colleagues, Ukrainian colleagues, who are historians that found a little bit more out from the historical records than they even learned in their families, because they were so painful with all of this dehumanization. Again, this role of methods of violence being most important, but I think the slow nature of dehumanization through starvation played a real role in the societal traumas and the reluctance of people to feel safe talking about this. I think even in the early years of Ukrainian independence, something that I was really interested in that I talk about in my wider work was people who didn't even feel safe talking about this. So I interviewed former President Viktor Yushchenko, for example. He did a lot with social memory, and he would tell me he was the president, and he would meet elderly women who were Holodomor survivors, and he would say, "Will you please write down your stories? I have my secretaries here. They can sit down with you and record your stories." And they would still, even during his presidency, speaking with a presidential figure, assuring them that it was safe to talk about the topic, they were still scared. That they were still scared to talk about it. And he said, "I think some people only tell those stories in their prayers." And so I think that the dehumanization has also played a role in some of the fear associated with talking about it.
Thank you. Thank you. That was an incredible answer. So we have a couple of questions from the audience. We'll jump back into the contemporary world with a question from Roman Serbin, who wants to know what you think is Putin's ultimate goal for his genocidal destruction of Ukraine and Ukrainians as a national and ethnic entity.
Yeah, it's a hard question because I don't like the answer that I see. I think what is going on today, I think that what I'm observing in contemporary Ukraine is a genocide orchestrated by Putin, but as we know, carried out by hundreds of thousands of other Russian perpetrators, ranging from direct perpetrators, so soldiers who were doing this horrific violence, all of the people working in occupation bureaucracies, the deportation bureaucracies. I will also mention that the records of forced deportation and taking people's passports, giving them new passports, was something that played a very important role in the International Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia. So the paper trail that creates, I'm expecting to be very important for legal prosecution. But then we have people who are working on the children's services. I really can't say that without quotation marks, because you know that it is clear from Article 2, Section E of the UN Genocide Convention that the forcible transfer of children from one group to another is a clear and legally recognized marker for genocide. So all of these people are playing a role. What I'm seeing today fits the case of genocide being waged against the Ukrainian national group, because I think one thing that's happened, and one thing that I think we really see from your area of expertise as well, Emily, is the role of people of different ethnic heritages in Ukraine today. So today we have the Day of Dignity and Freedom, which was started by someone who is obviously a proud Ukrainian, but who also has heritage, a father from Afghanistan. And so people with these different heritages that play a very important role Vitaly Kim. So he has Korean ancestry as well as being a proud Ukrainian patriot. There are many, many people. And in my other presentations, I talk about how diverse Ukraine is today. And those people are all being targeted as well. And so that's why it really makes sense to talk about Ukraine as a being targeted against the national group of Ukraine, what it means to be Ukrainian. And I do see this as a genocide. I have really argued strongly to be very suspicious of ceasefire, to be very suspicious of pauses to the conflict, because I think, like many of us are saying, for various reasons, that Russia will use this as a chance to regroup. Because what also is a hard answer from the field of genocide studies is that genocide studies indicates for us that this ends in victory for one side or the other. And I don't really want that to be a disempowering answer, because I like to remind people that modern Rwanda has its challenges, censorship and a lot of things, but the Rwandan genocide stopped because the military associated with the victim group won. So once a genocide is started, that the victim group can win militarily. We've seen it in other cases. Often outside interveners play an important role. That's what we saw in the Holocaust. It's what we are seeing today. Because again, for this perpetrator ideology that I'm talking about, destruction is the goal here. And I think it's about Ukraine. I think it's not just about Ukraine. I think that Putin really is trying to work towards this world order that he talks about a lot, but Ukraine is center for that because it's center to this very imperial notion about what Russia is and what it has rights over, claims to.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. We have a question that is specifically about Holodomor from Natalia Pavlenko. So there are still researchers who suggest that the Holodomor arose because of rapid Soviet industrialization, the collectivization of agriculture, which you mentioned briefly. Do you think that your research on establishing genocidal intent will substantively change that narrative about the Holodomor? And if not, why not? What are the barriers to really making a fundamental acceptance that this was in fact a genocide?
Great question. So I should also mention a few things too. I think that the case of the Holodomor shows how important it is to have people from various disciplinary backgrounds in the social sciences and humanities approaching this case. And so the work that I do is really indebted to historians. That's why I'm so pleased that we just had a question from Roman Serban, who's played a very important role in Holodomor scholarship, providing the historical, the historiographies, all those details, very important for me. But then what I bring to the table is this kind of awareness of what I'm looking for in this case that's very consistent with the way that I approach all the cases I've ever studied. So I want to point that out for a few reasons. In the work that I do, I've really focused on just the year of 1932 to 1933, because that's really seen, I think, all of us as the climax of violence. But there were really important famines before and after that other historians also bring to the table. And I will say again, that's not uncommon in the field of genocide studies. A lot of us think about 1994 Rwanda as 100 days of mass killing, but scholars who study that say we really should look at 1990 to 1994. So this idea of looking at a climax and then also broadening that scope to those surrounding dynamics is again really consistent with the way we approach cases. That to say that I don't know how my research will change that conversation, because I think that those surrounding dynamics will be important for people for various reasons for reconstructing that case. I think that genocidal intent should cause people, I would hope, with the conversations we're having in the wider field about decolonizing Russia's studies, to begin to reevaluate the evidentiary standard for some of the claims that might have worked a couple decades ago before we had access to records that we have now, such as explanations of just pure incompetence. I really don't find that very compelling or persuasive, having looked at more recently declassified records myself. So I don't know if it'll change all of those wider conversations that you mentioned, but I really do hope that it'll change this idea that the killing of at least 4 million people, according to demographers, which I am not, but the killing of at least that many people in under 2 years was just some terrible accident. I just don't find that persuasive.
Yeah. And frankly, from my own position, it seems like the more evidence and the more arguments based on evidence that we have, ultimately that does a service to the victims of this genocide And the more we call it a genocide in our own circles and then show the evidence that it was one, I think that's really something that we can contribute, even if maybe we don't see the fruits of that in the next few years along the line. As you've established, this whole field of genocide studies works in conjunction with a lot of others to make sure that, that definition is agreed on. So
that, if I can just jump in really quickly, I'm also arguing, and I think because the role of repressions, I say certainly not in Ukraine where these memories were preserved, but in the wider world, that Stalin nearly got away with this crime because of how much a lack of information, which led to the kind of flowering of propaganda around it, which we've really had to combat. And so I think that it's really important for the field of genocide studies to also look at this case. And that's on, when I'm talking with those colleagues, that's something I'm arguing about as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So we have a really interesting question from our audience Q&A. Do you know what happened to the Holodomor archives in the temporarily occupied territories? Have you heard of any attempts of Russian forces there to eliminate them? And I would ask this not just starting from February, but even back to 2014.
Some of the ways that I would talk about Holodomor to people outside of our Ukraine studies fields is I would say that this is something that might be externally opaque to you, but if you understand this story, you'll understand the nature of the armed conflict that's been happening for 8 or almost 9 years. We're about to have a year change. There was so much sensitivity around this topic on the Russian side. And so I was thinking today about the screening of Mr. Jones. It was about a year ago that was disrupted by masked men. It was held in Russia. And so even a fictionalized account, which was very well done Hollywood production, is too much for the society there. Or when we look today after the February escalation at the destruction of the Holodomor statue in Mariupol, similar stories that we had in the occupied territories prior to February, of this topic just being a dangerous topic for Russia because it reminds of Ukraine's past and present relationship with Russia. It hinted at these darker motivations that, you know, I think we're all horrified to watch come to pass, but that Ukrainians were well aware of. I put this in my article and I won't read the full quote. I'd refer you to the Our Life magazine. But I spoke with a curator at the Holodomor Museum in Kyiv, Yana Hrinko, and she talks about, she says very clearly that, like, she understands that that Putin's encroachment in Donbass and Crimea was not the end of it, that Putin was denying the reality of the Ukrainian state, the Ukrainian identity. She said this in May of 2017. For people willing to listen, that this story was really indicating the possibility of what we are just horrifically watching unfold today. I also realized I forgot to answer the question about archives. I'll briefly mention that. So I have heard about ways to preserve them, but I think that all of us who are very concerned about Ukraine's historical preservation, Ukraine's cultural heritage destruction, that we are trying to watch all of these things. I have heard of people working very hard to preserve these records and digitize things. I try not to comment about them a lot because there's always this awareness that we want them to be really successful. And so sometimes trying to be discreet about what people are doing so that those efforts don't get disrupted is my motto for now. But yes, people are in Ukraine are working very hard to preserve their cultural heritage, and we're all really supportive of that.
A related question from the audience from Olenka Krupa. Do you think that the scope of this genocide should extend prior to 2014? I don't know how easy that question is to answer, but I think it's worth addressing.
Thank you. Thank you to our audience member for that question. That is going to depend on the approach that people take to the case. And I mentioned the shorthand is that there are at least 4 professionals that bring something to the table for this topic, for the victims, for the world. But I do it in slightly different ways. Because I work in perpetrator ideology, I do tend to look at these climaxes of violence. So I look at 1932, 1933 in the Holodomor without at all trying to discount the other historiographies that are broadening that scope. And I would say that's probably how historians of the future are going to look at 2014 to 2022. When I'm looking at this case, there's a database that's being collected by Just Security at the Columbia Law School, and it's very helpful because it's keeping track of a lot of hate speech by key leaders in Russian society. And a lot of that language is going back to years before the current escalation. It's usually after 2014. So how far it goes back, I'm not sure. I will say for legal cases that in a legal case, they're looking for overlap of two different things, mens rea and actus reus, which means the motivation, the mind, the intent, and the actions. And so again, that you can think of that as the climax of things where it's very clear to prosecute the case when those are overlapping. Within scholarship, we tend to look at perpetrators having both the motive and the means, so the abilities. And what we might look at, if we look at this hate speech, was there an underlying Russian motivation for genocide before the escalation? And perhaps they were just constrained in their means for it for various reasons. We'll have to think about all of these things, but there are going to be various people who broaden the scope out and other people who just look at what I would call the climax without trying in any way to discount the overall dynamics.
That makes sense. Thank you. Thank you for that answer. I think we have time for one more question. We have one from our colleague, John Vstechka. He wants to know, what do you think the future of Holodomor studies looks like, and how does Russia's war against Ukraine affect the progress of future scholarship on the Holodomor?
Yeah, thanks so much, John. John is another excellent Holodomor scholar. I refer everyone to his work as well. It is really interesting to watch so many things in historical memory change in real time, just change before our eyes. So one of my Ukrainian colleagues that I've worked a lot with over the last 8 years, she and I were discussing it just today, because I'm blanking on the title of the song, but she sent me a song, which is heavy metal music. And she said, I never expected to see a Ukrainian heavy metal song with images of the Holodomor in it. And so it was the song is something about Russia is a terrorist state. We'll have to find it after, but it's images in this song, this current song that is a reflection of what we are all living through in this moment, having these video clips of the Holodomor to talk about long campaigns of Moscow terror against Ukrainians. And what I think I'm also seeing is I think there's a tendency of drawing strength from the past, different elements of the past, which can include the Holodomor, but I think we're also living through a moment that's going to be studied a lot for the memory of Ukraine, because I think heroes are being made every day right now in Ukraine. I think Azovstal has a real connotation, this steel plant in Mariupol, which was a last stand for many people. That name of a factory has a real resonance for many of us on the call, where before it might have just been a factory. And so I think we're living through both the transformation of historical memory, as well as the making of many of the people who will be heroes for Ukraine of the future. So where it all goes, I'm not sure. But what I do know is that people like you, Emily, John, and all of us here will certainly be there for it.
Thank you. That is just a beautiful sentiment for us to end on, and a positive note to close this discussion about some very difficult topics that's given us a lot to think about. So Christina, thank you so much for your work. Thank you so much for writing this article. And thanks so much for giving us the time for this conversation.
Thank you, Emily.
Thank you both very much for your time this evening. And thank you to all our guests for joining us this evening for what was a very interesting conversation. Let's hope that we see a swift end to what is currently unfolding in Ukraine. Thank you both to Emily and to Christina for the work that you do to continue to keep these topics alive and others as well in the scholarly communities as well as elsewhere. Thank you, everyone. Good night. Slava Ukraini.